I'd like to thank the committee for bumping me up to this position tonight. It's been a wonderful weekend for me so far. But yesterday, I was moving around, and I was looking for the speaker. Hadn't seen him yet. And one of the gentlemen that was working at the front table came and found me and said, "Hey, the speaker's looking for you." I said, "Okay." So he took me to him. And I had the most wonderful afternoon with Paul and his wife. And I've enjoyed our dinner together, and we've encountered each other throughout the day. My first impression of Paul and his wife, Christina, warm and wonderful, committed and involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight at dinner, I found out that we have a whole lot of other things in common, not just Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do know that I... And firmly believe with all my heart that you're in for a treat tonight. So could you please help me welcome Paul G. from Breckville, Ohio.
My name is Paul Gate. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 15th, 1991. My home group is the Newberg Group, Sunday nights, 8 o'clock in Cleveland, and there's no other place I would rather be on a Sunday night. You know, and before I get into this thing, these guys have done it. You know, I don't know if the people in the back can hear this stuff, but these guys are having a good time up here. You know, there's a whole lot of undercurrent going on that doesn't make it much past the front two rows, but... And maybe shouldn't. One of them's looking for a date. The other one might give some turkey calls later on, I understand. and it's clear they love to have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's, you know, and I've been a co-chair on a conference committee and a chair and a couple others on a couple of committees. And this is a multi-year commitment that it's a big deal. And I'd like to thank now for this wonderful weekend the people that put in that commitment and that work for it. All right. I'd also like to thank Butch for asking me and for the committee for honoring that choice. Butch was, I met him one afternoon. He was talking in Cleveland, and we just had the best time, just like tonight. You know, we just sat down next to each other, and it was like right off the bat. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where total strangers can reminisce. You know, you know, like you've known each other all your lives, you know, we're so accepting of each other, and the new people here, you know, give them a round of applause. And it's the ironies in Alcoholics Anonymous are never, they always strike me. You know, it's yeah, I hurt my family, I lost my job, and I burned my house to the ground. Yeah, I got fired last week, and my dog ran away, and I got flattened all my tires. And if there's probably about 15 or 20 people in this room that were in the restaurant on Friday. And we were over there, and you know, the waitresses were really up against it, and they seemed like they had an influx of people they weren't expecting. And I was trying to get the waitress's attention, you know, and as she was walking by, I was trying to tell her, well, bring us, Liz was gracious enough to invite us to join her. And I said, well, bring us our checks, because we had to get here for the early meeting on Friday. And she keeps on walking. Oh, yeah, and give us three more to-go baskets, and she keeps on walking, and maybe a glass of water. And at that last one, I overbalanced in my chair, and I went flat over backwards on my right in the middle of the restaurant floor over there. And only in alcohol, I get up and I go like this, and I look around and. Am I right, Liz? I And it's been a long time since I took a header like that, and so I never done it sober, much less in a restaurant. Oh, I love alcohol. I mean, the bottom line is it's a real serious deal here. You know, there's people saving their lives and changing their lives and getting their dreams back. You know, the dreams that they had lost, and replacing those with new ones and vital ones, you know. And right off the bat, you know, I got to say, I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything in my heart. Is there anybody here that likes it also? We got common ground then. And the new people, if you heard that, that was like a moderate reply. But inside, they're going, yes! You know, really, most of them, they'd like to do that, you know. But I wasn't always like that. I didn't jump into it right away. I really didn't feel it. Early on, I kind of recognized there was something going on here that I'd like to be a part of, but not right off the bat. You know, there's a few things that happen, and it kind of illustrates this, what we're doing here now. We're relating. And it's the spirit of identification in Alcoholics Anonymous, which to me I've been grinding on that for a while and thinking about how important that's been to me and to a lot of other people. You know, just relating our experience, strength, and hope, and meeting, having a meeting of the minds. We're not that much different, you know, what showed me that early on is I went to my home group one night, and there was this little black lady stood up there. She's about this tall, and she got up behind a podium telling her story, and she says, you know, back in the 30s, I used to come home from from the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd sit in front of my Victrola, and I'd listen to those Billie Holiday records, and those tears would come streaming down my face, she said. And I can understand that. And a couple of weeks later, I'm sitting at a meeting. Guy stands up at the podium and says, you know, back in the 50s, they developed hi-fi stereo, and I can remember coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk from the bar, and I'd put those stereo speakers together, sit in my living room carpet, and put on those Frank Sinatra records. And those tears would come streaming down my face. And I'm starting to think. Now I'm starting to think. You know, and I can remember back in '69, I'd come home and for 3 o'clock in the morning, put on them big Koss headphones, turn on a Jimi Hendrix to 10, and those tears would come streaming down my face. Really, and if you're new here in the program and you got an iPod with the earbuds, you know, and you come home and it's Nickelback or Merle Haggard or something, and those tears come, you belong here, you know. And a couple weeks ago, a guy came up to me and said, I do the same thing with Pearl Jam. You know? intense. We come in different sizes, shapes, flavors, and colors. But what's underneath a lot of that is the same deal. You know, and that's what we're celebrating here tonight. Total strangers reminiscing. You know, we share a common bond and a common ground that changed my life, changed these people's lives, and a whole lot of others in this room. Buckle up, you know, because as they told me, it keeps getting better. Drinking, you know, I was, but you know, I was a big kid, you know, for my age, and I jumped off drinking a bottle of Corby's, 13 years old, with my buddies. And if there's one thing I remember about that first big wham bam drunk is that I got more than my share. And I paid the consequences for getting more than my share that night. I was in a lying sick in the weeds while my buddies were snugging their sleeping bags, you know. Man, if there's one thing that was to follow my life, it's paying consequences for trying to get more than my share out of life in one kind of way or another, you know. And looking back on it, I was always paying some kind of consequence for doing that. My parents tried hard. They were good people. I didn't go hungry. I had clothes and shoes on my feet, and they tried to bring me a Christian upbringing, but I was big for my age. I was a little wild. My dad was a law and order type of guy. He used to be Elliot Ness's bodyguard. Elliot Ness used to be the safety director in Cleveland, and the younger people maybe know it. He was the Untouchables, you know. But he was his bodyguard. He's a real law and order guy, trained interrogator. And I was a liar, you know, so that was, he told me once he never asked me a question he didn't already know the answer to, and I thought that was a little unfair. That wasn't playing right, but he, but a good man, a good man nonetheless, and they tried hard. And Mom, I believe she single-handedly prayed me into this program. And, you know, she did her best, too. But like I said, I was big and I was wild, and I was a little bit on the headstrong side, you know, and so to speak. I lost my driver's license by the age of 14 when through a strange series of events. And you know, and they were trying to do right by me. So in 1967, they sent me to visit my brother at college, which was in Berkeley. Yeah, that was a game changer, you know. And they were trying to instill an appreciation for higher learning in me. And Berkeley in 67, that was, you know, and he was on campus there. And while he was on campus, I was over at Haight-Ashbury in the city, and you know, riding those buses around. And I came back. I lasted a year. I lasted about a year and a half, actually, in high school, before I packed my guitar, packed a suitcase, bought a one-way ticket to San Francisco for $60. You know, and I was fully intended on spending the rest of my life out there. You know, and that's what I was going to do. And I got off of that plane and I went straight to the beach. You know, I'm thinking California, palm trees and hula skirts and stuff like that. Northern California coastline is not quite like that. You know, I went to that beach and it was freezing and the fog was coming in. I was trying to sleep about in those woods above Cliff House over there on a coastal highway, and the sea lions were barking down and the waves were crashing on the rocks and the fog and the ocean liners out there and stuff. I had to get out of there. That wasn't going to last. I moved down to the Embarcadero, and that's where I found my home. That was the San Francisco waterfront. And really, that was when it was a real waterfront still. You know, they had the wooden wharfs, and you could hear those wharfs creaking and stuff when the tide would come in. And it had big wharf rats and winos beating themselves up in the street all night long, and neon signs. It was great. I loved it. I was having the time of my life out there. And I made these friends, and they were they taught me how to drink that wine. You know, out of a paper sack, you know, you roll it up tight around the neck and you hide it, and you know, you just pull it out, and Mad Dog wine. Mogan Day, nectar of the gods. Right on the label, if some of you probably remember, it said the wine of the century. I don't know what that means, but it was, boy, and you take it, and it was warm, you know, and you take a hit of that, and the first... The first hit wasn't good, but you take the second hit, it's, oh yeah, you know, there's something happened, you know, there's something happened between the first and the second, and then it's on, and the third hit, it's, yes, it was good stuff, and really, I was having fun, and on Friday nights, we go up to the little dance hall above the Cadillac dealership up on Fillmore Street to hear the house band. And his dance hall was called the Fillmore. It wasn't the Fillmore West yet, but at that time it was the Fillmore, and the house band was called the Grateful Dead, and they'd start playing about 6 in the evening, and they wind up about 6 in the morning, and more often than not, we'd be sleeping on the floor all night, and it was, and on Sunday afternoon, we go over to Provo Park in Berkeley and listen to Country Joe do his thing over there with the fish, and it was a real heady experience, you know. For a 16-year-old kid. And these are the impressionable things that I brought back with me when they kicked me out of the state. You know, they put me in jail and they kicked me out of the state, the nerve of them. I was in the state without a legal guardian, you see, and they found me over there. So they sent me back on a plane, you know, and on Friday night I came back and my parents loved me. You know, I used to think, well, geez, I beat them. When I was a kid, I thought I beat them. You know, I my will prevailed, but they loved me enough to let me go. You know, and as a parent, and as a that's got to be a lot of love. I know that's got to be a lot of love, and I didn't realize that, you know, at the time. But they loved me enough to let me go, which meant to me I could go out on Friday night, and that's what I did. The first Friday night back off the plane, I went out and I got blasted, or wasted. Or obliterated, or like Natasha said, blotto, you know, these are the adjectives we used to describe our drink, and there was nothing moderate about it. There was obliviated, you know, or pedal to the metal, drink it as fast as he can, and go get some more. And really, you know, I might quote a couple of the speakers here because, gosh, did they do some good work? There's the diversity of the speakers here. I was struck by the diversity of the speakers here. There's something here for everybody, you know. And I might quote, because that was some good stuff. I might end up quoting some of these guys. So I hope they excuse me, and if I don't call out their name, but every one of them was. Could we have a round for them guys? You know, it's you know, my wife said, "What a diverse group of speakers they had here." And really, it was. It was, you know, something for everybody. There's bulldozers and Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's people with the kid gloves, you know, and it's everything in between. But yeah, Natasha was Blotto, and I picked that up from her. That's a while back, but we were getting obliviated and messed up, and that's what we would do. And I ended up graduating from high school, and after going to 5 different high schools, you know, and they tried, but I graduated, and I ended up, the same thing started happening with my jobs. You know, I started going from job. My first job was on this, in the pharmaceutical industry, so to speak, and that's all I'm going to say about that. The second job was on this cleaning crew. I was working on this night cleaning crew, and I saved every nickel and dime I could, and with my first $775, I bought myself a Harley Davidson, and that was it. You know, with that, I bought myself a lifestyle. It wasn't a means of transportation; it was a lifestyle. And for years afterwards, I led the biker lifestyle, building and drag racing Harley Davidsons. Was really what I devoted most of my talents, energies, and adult life to. And I ended up getting fired from that job too. I ended up with another job, you know. And it was a night cleaning crew job. And I considered this to be menial labor. You know, I thought this stuff was beneath me or something. I didn't yet know that all work is honorable. You know, if we're carrying our own weight in the world, it's a good. You know, we're making a contribution. We're not freeloading anymore. We're doing something. You know, but I thought it was beneath me. You know, and they thought I was working there, but really I was casing the joint. And on Friday night, I was going to steal all their auto body tools or micrometers. I forget what, but I was going to steal everything they had on Friday night, but I never made it because Thursday found me in jail for assaulting a police officer with a deadly weapon. That was the charge, you know, and I wasn't really at heart a violent type of person. I certainly wasn't brought up that way, but I remember on that particular day, I perceived this police officer to be getting between me and my drink. You know, the party was on that evening. I knew where we were going to go, and everything was set. I didn't want anybody interfering with those plans, but this guy got between me and that. And something snapped inside of me, and I became willing to go to any lengths to avoid capture that day. Any lengths, you know, it didn't matter, and it was. There were a lot of lengths I went to, and I just had to get away. And, you know, I'd seen Bullitt and Steve McQueen and those the Shelby GT Cobras, you know, riding through those streets and car chases and stuff like that. And this involved one of those. And it was, it was just like you see on America's Wildest Police Chases, you know, except they didn't have the helicopters. But it was through suburban streets and on two wheels over people's front lawns, turf flying in hot pursuit. My escape vehicle was a 66 Volkswagen Beetle with a slip and clutch. They'll never take me alive, you know. You know, a ponytail flying out the window, you know. I didn't have the best judgment. Another hallmark of my early life is I was always undershooting the mark. You know, I didn't know what a measured response was to any given situation in life. You know, somebody might tell me that his brother-in-law died, and I'd laugh or something like that. I didn't know how to respond appropriately to people in life, no matter what it was, and that was one of them. You know, but you know, I ended up getting a break on that one. You know, and if there's one thing, I got a lot of breaks. over the years. And if there's one thing that I had in common with all my breaks is I didn't learn a thing from any of them. You know, I never learned nothing from a break. And there's a guy, Marty W., from my home group. I had 2 years sober. He stood up on the east side over there at a meeting, and I happened to be listening to him, and he said that night. I never learned nothing from a break. And he's got this voice like that. But it just sunk right into me. It was a moment of clarity in my sobriety. You know, I come in these rooms, and I could hear people say the same thing a number of different times, but that night, that got through to me. I never learned nothing from a break. It was consequences. Consequences that drove me into these rooms. You know, and I was trying to avoid consequences, so I got sneaky. You know, and I ended up going through a bunch of other jobs. And eventually, I got a job in a steel mills down there in Cleveland, and I became a steel mill electrician. You know, and then I got my first line of credit. You know, I got a bar tab. And I was like, you know, and I felt like a real adult almost, you know, line of credit and all that stuff. So I'd go up to that, and 3 weeks later, it was maxed out. 3 weeks later, I was taking my check up there, giving them the check, and they'd put me in a new card. My life started revolving around the bar at the top of the hill above the steel mills. And it was always the last place I'd stop on the way down the hill and the first place I'd stop on the way back up. And usually there wasn't a second stop. You know, because once I started, I was in my element. I was where I wanted to be, you know, and I was sitting in there and working on that bar tab. And I used to like these bars that had a dark corner. And I always start in this dark corner. And I'd order one, and I'd order two, and maybe a third. And as I had a few in me, I'd start to move up a little bit. I'd feel a little bit better, a little more comfortable, because I was extremely uncomfortable around people. Four, five, six, I'd start to move up. And by the time I had six, seven, or eight, I'd be up by the cash register, telling jokes, shooting pool, putting quarters into the jukebox. You know, I was human, being human. And this is the way I wanted to feel in life, and the way I woke up every morning to feel. And my humanness in life, looking back on it, was somewhere between maybe 5 and 8 drinks. And truth be told, if I could have kept that little window opportunity open when I was shooting up my rocket, I might not be standing here tonight. You know, but I couldn't, and I knew no moderation, and 8 drinks turned into 12 drinks, and 12 drinks turned into 15, and by now I start, my pool shot got unsteady, and my tongue would get thick, my jokes were falling flat, and I'd start working my way back down the bar to that dark corner, down at the end of the bar, you know, and to spend the rest of the night there, and really the rest of my, and that was kind of the definition of a lot of my drinking. I mean, the place has changed, and 2:30 in the morning, it'd find me, just like when I was a kid, 2:30 in the morning, find me in the back getting sick while the other kids were snugging their sleeping bags. You know, it's the age changed, but the situations, really, if you look at them, are all the same. You know, and I thought, I thought I was a musician. I had this guitar career going, and I thought the key to successful drinking is the same as it is in musicianship. You know, practice, practice, practice. So I practiced, 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 and it just got worse. You know, I ended up, my friends were dying. You know, I had a bunch of road dogs. We had all my close friends. We grew up together. We were like a tight-knit bunch. We all got our bikes together and all went on our first dates together and did a whole lot. We were very tight, but, Donnie died, was beat to death behind a bar, and Butch was beat to death on Carnegie Avenue down there, and Stanley died from a pancreatitis. Frankie died from cirrhosis of the liver. Benji died. We don't know how he died. We just know he did. Pat died on the Mexican border. You know, 17 of them, 17 of my closest friends, a few of them died at 100 miles an hour on the back of a Harley, and that's the way I wanted to go. And I was already making my plans, long-range plans. And really, I wasn't making any new friends, so more and more I'm becoming alone in life. And more it's I'm just a loner, and I can remember looking through those bottles and sitting at that dark corner of that bar, just looking through those bottles. looking in that mirror at those hollow eyes, you know, wondering. Sometimes in my more lucid moments, I would wonder, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to get off of this thing? You know, what's going to change about this? But more often than not, it was just a blank stare and oblivion. And I would get obliviated. And I kept on like that. You know, eventually I got in some trouble. I guess you could just say, I know what it means when they say make a federal case out of something, you know. I didn't see what the big deal was, but they did, you know. And if there might be a couple people in here that have seen a federal indictment. But if you've never seen a federal indictment, it comes on this real thick, heavy parchment. You know, and it's gotten this gothic, fancy gothic lettering across the top. It says the United States of America in a big arc across the top. And underneath that it says in plain Arial font, it says versus Paul Gadeck. You know, and bring it on. I'm thinking, bring it, a worthy opponent at last. You know, in my ego and my cockiness, you know, I was like, yeah. Yeah, I felt like John Dillinger or somebody. You know, I was just a two-bit punk criminal. You know, but now I'm waiting for my break. You know, I always got a break, and I'm looking for my break to come. And I'll tell you what, these guys dot their I's and they cross their T's, and they took their time with this deal. And for a year or two, I'm riding around with this big basketball behind my belt. If I didn't have a bottle of Mad Dog on the back of that Harley. Behind my belt, there was this big empty space inside that it didn't feel good, you know. And now I'm starting to feel this sense of impending doom. In the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, they have this concept called impending doom, you know. And I knew the end was coming. I didn't know where it was coming from or which direction or when it was going to arrive, but I knew life as I knew it was going to stop. I began to feel like a juggler, you know. I was juggling all these problems in life, you know, my rent payments and my landlords and my court cases and my jobs or my lack of jobs and you know, I got to get tires. My car doesn't have any gas. Whatever it was, I'm juggling all these balls and knowing that I can't keep going on with it. One of these days, soon, it's going to stop, you know, and I'm out of control, and I sense that, and I didn't like that. I didn't like that. Anyway, long story short, I stood up there in front of that judge, and I stood up as straight as I could, and my lawyer ended up getting me some kind of probation on the deal. You know, I was looking at 5 years in the federal penitentiary, but they said to me at the investigation deal over there that they had before they were going to sentence me, they said, do you want to get help or do you want to go to jail? You can't keep going like this. It says, are you going to get help or are you going to go to jail? And I said, give me a week to think about that. and really, I swear to God, it sounds like an exaggeration or it sounds silly or anything like that, but that was my mindset. That's exactly what I told him. Give me a week to consider this, because I didn't want to make any rush decisions on that. Because, and truth be told, in my mind, the concept of getting help, I didn't know what that meant, but it was a terrifying type of thought. You know, I remember going to just anything normal was a terrifying type of thought. You know, they'd send me from the steel mills. I was an electrician down there, and technology was coming into the workplace and the computers, and they would send me down to the local college for continuing education, and it was terrifying. You know, it was extremely stressful to have to be amongst normal people, and it was extremely stressful being in that courtroom amongst the normal people, and trying to get any kind of help was a terrifying proposition. But finally, I made a brilliant decision and said, sure, I'll get your help. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I'll do your jail bit afterwards. You know, when the help fails, whatever they want to do with me, I'll do your jail bit afterwards. And that was it. And they told me to make arrangements. So they told in a week, and it took me 3 weeks. you know, dragging my feet to the last. And I hope I never, you know, for years I had led that lifestyle, and for years I drank to excess, and I was going down all the while. My friends dying, and personal hygiene had long since gone by the wayside. I hope I never forget the state of my life. You know, I was living like an animal in a cave. I was, my utilities were all, we heard that. That's a common thread this weekend of having trouble with your utilities. My car had bald eagles on all fours around it. You know, if I had a running car, you know, either the phone was turned off or the electric was turned off or the gas, and the rent was always months behind. I remember I had bags of garbage lined up by the door waiting to take it out. I was just too lazy, forgetful, or in another place to remember to take it out. On garbage day, dirty dishes were piled high in the sink. You know, the toilet was stopped up. I used it anyway. The shower was stopped up. I didn't use it. You know, and at any given time, you know, a full day's meal would be Kraft macaroni and cheese, you know, 79 cents, put in a bowl, a little water, salt and pepper, and that was my full day's sustenance, or Morton pot pies. You know, anything under a buck, you know, and if I had a little extra money, I'd get the kind with the crust on the bottom, too, as a treat, you know. You know, and the blankets covering the windows, we heard that too. Blankets covering the windows, and when a knock would come at the door, I'd run and hide and peep out the bathroom window to see who was coming to get me. You know, I had this paranoid mentality going on, and it wasn't, it was just from a consequence of the way I was living, the way I was alienating myself from the world. You know, I didn't want to be around people, and I was hiding, and I was driven by a thousand forms of fear. Self-delusion and shame, you know, all that stuff. And all the while, I'm riding around in this Harley in these leathers and chains and boots and stuff with this Marlon Brando look on my face, you know, trying to keep people away. You know, I didn't find this stuff out till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a lot of what was driving me was the fear underneath. And that's the way I was, and that's the way I left my life. And arrived on your doorstep, basically, because I ended up at one of those hospitals, and out by the Pennsylvania border over there, and they said, you know, it was I guess it was I remember intake in the place, and they gave me the MMPIs and the psychological evaluations, and then they had all that stuff going, and really I don't remember a whole lot about it, but they seemed to be professional, you know, and there were a lot of professionals in there, true enough. And as the days wore on, you know, they had the college educated counselors, and they had Jahari's window, and to keep keep their license with the state, they had the chalk talks, and like I say, the psychological evaluations and all that stuff. But looking back on it, the course of treatment that they offered after that was done was Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the 12 and 12 and the 24-hour book, and it was groups surrounding around that. You know, and I recognize the difference sometime early on, you know, and the professionals, true enough, you know, they talked a good game and everything they said made sense. But there was something that was missing, you know. These people didn't really know what it was like to live without hope. They didn't know what it was like to wake up in the morning at rock bottom. Just with terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair, and all the rest of that. They didn't know that. However, fortunate for me, there was another subset of counselors in the place that were all members of Alcoholics Anonymous with years of sobriety. And I knew these guys when I would listen to them talk, and when I would talk to I knew these people knew what it was like to live without hope. You know, I knew they felt my pain and knew what it was like. When they related things to me and they say, "I know what you're feeling," I knew they did. You know, and that was a big deal. I remember that to this day. You know, and that's it's back to that spirit of identification and that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was important to me. It made me listen. It perked up my ears a little bit. I don't remember a whole lot of went on. You know, there were two pivotal things that happened in this place for me. You know, and one of them was, I don't know, I had some 10 or 15 days sober, and my counselor caught me. It was one of these chance encounters that we have so often in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of these chance encounters. Dave caught me in one of the upstairs hallways on his way out the door, and he had all those books, all those MMPIs and evaluations and stuff, and he pulled me into this an empty room on the side, an empty office. And he said, "Here, come here, I want to talk to you." And he seemed real intense about this. You know, and I'm like, what did I do now? You know, guilty conscience. So he puts down all those books, and he says, and I could still see the sunlight coming in low through the window. It was October 1991, and it was 5 o'clock, and I could see the dust. You know, I could see it like it was yesterday. It was a moment of clarity. And he says, "You know, first day out of this place, first night, I want you in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." And he got real intense about it. I said, "What's the big deal?" "No," he says, "I want a promise out of you right here and now. First day out of this place, first night, I want you in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Promise me now." "Okay, Dave. All right. If that's what you want, I'll promise." And I promised him that. And there was honor amongst thieves, and he's a thief and I'm a thief. So I intended on keeping that promise. You know, and that was it. He picked up his stuff and he went out, and I went down to chow. And simple as that. The man might have saved my life right then and there. Might have saved my life right then and there in the space of 30 seconds. The other thing I remember about the place was I went to my first meeting there. You know, and at this time, by this time, Tony might remember this. You know, by this time I was a senior peer. So I had about 17 days sober, and a senior peer was kind of like an old-timer in treatment center talk. And as a senior peer, I had responsibilities, you know, and it was a senior peer's responsibility to welcome the AAs that were bringing in an outside meeting from the surrounding community. So I did my duty. I went to the door, and I was shaking. I shook the one guy's hand who came in the door, welcome. Shook the next guy's hand that came to the door, welcomed our facility, and up the aisles coming this beautiful woman. You know, she's tall and statuesque, and she has these clear eyes and this flashy white smile. And wow, she was pretty. And she was clear-eyed, and she looked me in the eye, and she grabbed my hand, and she shook my hand. You know, firm hand grip and all that, and oh, wow. You know, and we ended up filing into the meeting room. Turns out she's the speaker that night. You know, and really, I've been in enough groups now, and they had, by this time, they had pointed out to me where my most cherished beliefs were false. You know, everything I thought was white turned out to be black. Everything I thought was up turned out to be down. They pointed out where I was, everything, my most cherished beliefs and my dreams were hollow. You know, my whole world was turned upside down, and I believed them, and I saw that. You know, and I'm sitting in that meeting room in my first meeting with a plastic tag around my wrist and my pajamas and slippers, 3 days from a good bath. But the only thing I knew for sure at that moment was that she wanted me. Typical new guy, you know. I knew it. I could tell by the look in her face. She did her job that night. She did her job. She carried a message of strength and hope from the heart. Her God gave her the words to throw out there that changed my mind. In the space of an hour, her messages changed my mind totally about who she was, about how I viewed people, about how I viewed her. And walking out of that place, she was... I saw her as a child of God, worthy of my respect, and more. You know, it was a deep experience, another moment of clarity. You know, and I learned that. So I walked out of the place, and they turned me out on the street, and they dropped me off in my car. I had my keys. I had $10 in my pocket. It was I had 22 days sober, and it was sunny. And I started thinking, you know, I had 22 days sober, and it's sunny, and I got this $10, and I got the car, it's 2 in the afternoon. What more natural thing would be to celebrate, you know? And that's what I did. And a half hour later, I'm walking in the back door to Finn Cafe up on Broadway, you know, to celebrate. Now, that's how long I lasted, you know? No mental defense whatsoever. No mental defense. And I open up that back door, and the smell hits me, and Boy, I'm already sensitive to the smell of alcohol, and I could smell that. My mouth starts watering. I'm walking up that back hallway, and the stuff starts going through my mind. You know, after all those people did for me, after all they told me, after all they pointed out to me, and after all their efforts, here I come. I'm still walking up. And I approach the bar. Am I nuts? Why am I doing this? And I couldn't stop myself. And I sat down at my bar stool, and I ordered my wash. The barmaid comes over, and I said, "Well, give me a ginger." You know, and when she comes back, I'm gonna get a double Jack. I remember it like it was yesterday. In the time she walks away, that little squirter thing. She's pouring my glass of wash. And I'm watching her pour that little squirter thing, and on her way back, and a couple thoughts crossed my mind. You know, I'm thinking I wasn't physically ill. I had promised Dave that I was going to a meeting on my first night. Maybe I better go sober, because after all, I had to keep the feds happy, and I'd never been to an outside meeting. I didn't know whether you guys had breathalyzers here or what. Maybe I better just scope out the lay of the land. And I can always celebrate. And wasn't I man enough to make it one day without a drink? And at that last thought, I thought, well, since all those other things were... And really, this whole conversation in my head takes about 3 seconds. You know, I guess I could make it one day without a drink. And I put a buck up on the bar, and I got up and I walked out. And I got in my car, and on the seat next to me was the books they gave me walking out of the treatment center. It was the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the local meeting schedule. And I picked up that meeting schedule, and I found out where there was a meeting where I knew where it was. And I drove over there around the corner from the place overlooking the railroad tracks over there and looked at those railroad tracks for 5 hours. I didn't want to move. I didn't want to move. I think I knew how close I had come. I didn't want to touch anything. I didn't trust myself. I just let me go to this meeting tonight. Just let me scope out the lay of the land. Just let me see what this thing's about. You know, at 10 to 8, I started up the car and I drove over to the meeting. You know, and I parked the car and I walked down the meeting, and they had these long steps down there. And they had people down at the bottom greeting the people that came down the steps. And I'm clomped down in my Fry boots and my jeans and my chains and my leather and my long hair and my Marlon Brando look on my face. And there's this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid, about 21 years old. He looks me up and down, says, "Are you new?" I don't know. "Yeah, no, maybe, I don't know, I guess, whatever. What's, you know, yes, no, maybe." He says, "Listen, go grab some coffee, grab a donut, meet us by the table over there." So I did. I grabbed the coffee, grabbed the donut, met him by the table over there. And, you know, and I don't know, I'm sitting there surveying my surroundings in this meeting, and the meeting starts, and there's five other people sitting at the table around me. And I don't know what it was, but there was some kind of vibe I was picking up at this meeting. And I don't know if it's anything the speaker said or the looks of and the people in their eyes or the tone of their voices or like we were talking before the meeting, just the general happy sound of the clamor of happy voices or whatever about it. You know, there was something. The people were demonstrating ease and comfort in life. You know, they had clear eyes and they were comfortable in their own skin, and that was totally foreign to a person like me. That was a foreign concept, and there was something attractive about that. I felt safe that night. There was something, some little thing of safety going on there too, and I got number. You know, the people did their jobs that night. This is a guy I'm going out and celebrating the next day. I'm just scoping it out. I'm giving you one chance. You know, one shot. You got one shot. Better make it. It was just another Tuesday night to these people. They saved my life. You know, they made me feel welcome. They did their job in Alcoholics Anonymous that night. They made the new person feel welcome. I haven't had a drink since. I haven't had a drink since. I've never found it necessary to go out and have that celebration. Because based on that one night, I decided I'd try it again the next night. You know, and the next night I did my job. You know, I had a few, they told me to get phone numbers. So I don't know what I'm going to do with these phone numbers, but I got these five phone numbers. And first guy on the list, Bill. So the next night, let me see if these meetings really feel the same. So the next night, I called Bill, And his wife answers the phone on the other line, and I say, "Hey, you know, I met Bill at the meeting the other night. Is he home?" And she says, "Are you new?" I don't know how they know it. I don't know. What is it with these people? You know? Yeah. I say, "Yes, no, maybe. You know, I guess. You know, whatever. I met Bill the other night. Is he home?" She said, "No, he went out for some pizza. I'll have him call you as soon as he gets in." I hung up the phone. I said, I knew it. I knew this thing was too good to be true. I knew this thing wasn't going to work like I thought it was. I knew the feelings were falling. I was looking for a way out, I think. Anyway, I was putting on my jacket, getting ready to head for the door, and the phone rings. And I pick it up, and it's Bill. He says, "Sure, come on over. You know, we have a big book study in the living room here on Friday nights. That's what I got the pizza for. After that, we go to the midnight meeting up the street, and you can stay over if you want. On Saturday mornings, we go down to the Carter Manor downtown for the breakfast meeting, some greasy eggs, greasy bacon, and a good lead." And he had me hooked up for the whole weekend already, and I had just met the guy two nights before. You know, it was inclusive. They drew me in. You know, as much as I tried to keep people at arm's length by the looks on my face and the way I carried myself in my speech, and they drew me in. They saw through that. They saw through the fear, and they sucked me in and set me to walking. You know, we were and I was getting active. You know, ended up getting a sponsor. And the more meetings I went to, the better I felt. So I started going. You know, and I started doing things, they got me active. I was going every night, and before too long, I was going pretty darn often. You know, my sponsor, he ended up, I ran into this guy at a meeting, and I'll tell you what, just the chance, as long as I'm thinking about it, just the chance encounters. And Natasha was talking about, we all carry our own set of miracles when we come into here, and boy, that resonated with me. You know, because looking back in it, I had a set of miracles, and I believe everybody in this room has a set of miracles that are destined for them. All we got to do is walk the path that we're supposed to be walking. You know, let go and let a higher power possibly show us the path instead of being self-directed for once. You know, so when a suggestion was made to me to go make coffee at a meeting, I had to go make that coffee at a meeting because I don't know what I'm supposed to hear that night. And time after time, I've proved that to myself and continue to this day that I might hear something pivotal. You know, and looking back, I heard maybe 3, 4, 5 things pivotal, a snippet of a conversation or observe somebody doing a kind act or a good deed to somebody in a corner that's literally changed the course of my life in moments. In moments. I was on the elevator with somebody, I believe, and we were talking about it's a program of inches and seconds or moments or something like that. But boy, how true is that? You know, how true is that? But for any one of those given moments, I might not be standing here today. You know, and so I found my sponsor like that. And my sponsor gets me active. He believes gratitude is action. He believes gratitude is not talked about. Gratitude is demonstrated. You know, I was riding down the street with him. I dug up a 12-step call. I wanted to get active. I had heard about this concept, and I found a guy that wanted to get sober. So I pick him up, and I wanted to see the way he does this stuff. You know, I said, let's go. I got this guy. He's hot. He wants it. We're riding down the street. He says, "Man, I was this high." I said, "Man, I could talk some gratitude, Tim." And his head turned around like that Exorcist girl. and he stopped dead, and he says, "Uh-uh." He says, "Gratitude is not talked about. Gratitude is action. Gratitude is demonstrated. It's not a noun, it's a verb." And he said it in such a way that it was a heavy-duty thing. I remember it to this day. And so I picked up on that. I picked up, okay, get me active. He says, "All right, well, go pick up Bill and Tom on Friday night and take them down to the West Clifton group," which was our home group at the time, a big group, Friday night in Lakewood, 225 people every Friday night. It was a show, you know. So I picked up these two guys and took them down that Friday night, and I felt pretty good for doing that. I was doing something useful in life, and the next week he says, "Well, go pick up Tom and Ellis and take them down to West Clifton on Friday night." So I go on, I do my duty, I pick up Tom and Ellis and take them down to West Clifton on Friday night, and I felt pretty good for doing that. And the next week he says, go pick up Jim and Dan and take them down there to West Clifton on Friday night. So I go pick up Jim and Dan, and I'm driving back to West Clifton, and I start to think. You know, he's down there in the back row, eating coffee and donuts, joking with all his friends, smoking cigarettes. I'm out here riding my gas around, picking up all his, these new guys for him and stuff. I walk down the steps that night. I said, hey, man, I'm doing your footwork for you. His head turns around like that Exorcist girl. Says, you're doing God's work. Says, you're doing God's work. I don't know how he comes up with it. You're doing God's work. I mean, it was like he was waiting for me. There isn't much of a comeback for that. And I knew I had read it somewhere in one of these books that we had a new employer. Yeah? I guess I'm working for the big guy now. I felt a little bit better about that. Okay, man, what do you want me to do next week? He says, go to Serenity Hall, the local treatment dryout joint. Go to Serenity Hall and visit Carl. I'm like, Tim, I got two months sober. What am I going to tell a new guy in a treatment center? He says, you got $8, $10? Take him a carton of cigarettes. Okay, I guess I could do that. So I went and I bought a carton of Marlboros, and I took it up to the treatment center to visit this guy, Carl. And really, this place had these white hallways and these marble floors and this real institutional feel about the place. Made me nervous, you know. And I'm approaching the detox place up there, and there's this big bench, and these two burly-looking nurse ratchets up there guarding the doors of detox, you know. And really, they're women. I'm not comfortable with women, figures of authority, or people in uniform, and they're all three. So I approach the bench, and I say, ma'am, I'm here to visit Carl. And they said, they looked down at me from up there. They said, are you a relative of Carl? And I said, no, ma'am, I'm not. They said, well, we only allow relatives to visit the patients in detox. And I said, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And I turned on my heel, and I'm walking away, and I'm five steps down the corridor, and I hear, hey, you! And I turn around, and off to the side, there's an open doorway, and there's this little red-haired lady, about this tall, about 100 pounds, sticking her head out there. She says, hey, you, are you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm like, geez, all these people around, you know, everybody looks. And it was put up or shut up right then and there. It was put up or shut up. And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. And she gets up off her chair, and she comes out there. She grabs me by the arm. She waltzes me past that nurse's station. HIPAA be damned. Busts open the doors to detox and leaves me there. She goes back out. The door swings shut. The guys look up from their whatever they're doing over to who's this loser until they spot my cigarettes, you know, carrying the message. You know. And I'll tell you what, I walked out of that, those doors of detox 2 hours later, and my feet were this high off the ground. You know, my feet were, I just, it changed my life. Alcoholics Anonymous opened up doors for me that day. And really, truth be told, Alcoholics Anonymous has been opening doors for me ever since, in one kind of way or another, in big ways and in little ways, but opening up doors nonetheless. And really, the beautiful part about this whole story, and the back end to it, is that it's 18 years later right now, and that little red-haired lady turns out to be my wife's sponsor, you know, and is just been such a... I can't say enough about the synchronicity that we find in alcohol. And that stuff happens all the time. Our own set of miracles. You know, how does this stuff happen? You couldn't write a script that it'd work out like this sometimes. It's just a gift. I can't say enough about it. Opening up doors. So I'm going on through life, and really I'm going to 18 meetings a week, and I jumped on the bandwagon, and things are getting better, and I got rubber on the wheels of my car now, and I'm taking these new guys to meetings. I went to Right out of this hospital, I went to a three-quarter way house. I stayed in this three-quarter way house for 4 years. Really, it was 4 years until the people in the community said, "Move on, dude. You know, make room, make room for the new guy or something." You know, but I was loving it. I was feeling pretty good, and I was getting active in Alcoholics Anonymous and doing good stuff. And I'd be sitting every now and then. Somebody would get up at the podium and say, "You know, my 10th year was my worst year in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'd be sitting in the back row in the inventory section judging these people. And I'd say, "Dude, if your 10th year is your worst year in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're missing something, right? You got to pick up more new guys. You better revisit that third step." And then the next week, somebody would get up there and say, "You know, I was going on through life, and I was saying my prayers and doing all the right things, and my 10th year was my worst year in Alcoholics Anonymous." And there it is again. I said, "What's wrong with these people? You know, can't they get their lives together? Well, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, you know? Well, I'm here to tell you, my 10th year was my worst year in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I was picking up my do, guys. I was saying my prayers. I was doing my steps. You know, the steel mills closed down. I lost that job I had for 27 years. They just pulled the rug right out. It was that sucking sound from down south, NAFTA or whatever. Anyway, that's something else. I apologize for that. Anyway, they shut down. You know, I had to go, some wreckage of the past cropped up. I had to go through a year of those interferon treatments. It was basically chemotherapy and a whole bunch of other stuff happened. You know, but never once was there any thought of any other way to live but within the sphere of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, never once. I just kept on doing the basics, the things that I learned when I first came in, and I went right through that, and I walked through that, and I kept on picking up my new guys, and I kept on saying my prayers, and I tried to do the next right thing. You know, and sometimes a moment at a time. And I ended up getting through that, and I ran towards my fears. You know, they told me that early on. Some guy told me, "Run towards your fears. Don't run away from them, because they'll be nipping at your heels the rest of your life." And invariably, they're not what my fears are never what I always built them up to be. You know, so I did that, and I got through that stuff. And I eventually started up a electrical business, and that ended up taking off, became an entrepreneur, so to speak, and that is something I always wanted to do. It was a little personal dream of mine. That came up, and the steel mills came back, and, you know, and those interferon treatments turned out pretty good, and so far I'm negative on all that deal, and I got out the back end of that thing, and I kept on doing it, and I keep on doing that to this day. You know, life kept on going. You know, and I just kept on doing the things that I was taught early on. You know, what more to do? It wasn't that simple. It wasn't rocket science. It was just as simple as that. Just keep on doing it. And if the new people that are here, man, that's a lot of what it is, just doing the next right thing. And the constant activity bought me time to put the steps in my life in a real fashion. You know, developing faith and reliance in a higher power they told me to do. You know, and I immersed myself in the fellowship. You know, I'm proud to be a member of this fellowship. I am proud to be a member of this fellowship. There's nothing like this. You know, I've been around the world a little bit. There's nothing like this. You know, my dad, Elliot Ness's bodyguard, he passed away last September 18th at the age of 99. What a man. Yeah, you know, it took me to get sober to realize the man he was. And it was only through the examples set most notably by my sponsor. If you haven't got a sponsor who's been through the steps and is active in Alcoholics Anonymous, get one. You know, but most notably through the efforts of my sponsors and watching the way he handled these types of things and through the examples of other people like you in Alcoholics Anonymous, was directly proportional to the level of care to being there for my dad. You know, he ended up in a nursing home, a protracted illness, and it was but I was able to be there for him. I was able to suit up and show up and do what I need. I knew it was right. You know, years ago, I couldn't have imagined. You know, years ago, I used to wish harm on my parents. It's all changed. You guys changed my mind about everything, and I was there. You know, he passed away, and you know, my little mother, my mother's 97. She's 96, and I'll never forget it. She looked up at me after he passed away, and we're making the funeral arrangements. She looked up at me, and she says, "Who's going to come? All our friends are dead." You know, well, you guys came. You guys came. The members of my home group came. You know, and she was just beside herself. What kind of gratitude do I have to have for that? Where do I pay that back? Where do I pay that back? What do I got to do? I'll do it. You know, you guys came. One of the people in the room come up and whispered in my ear throughout the middle of this the funeral. Says something to the effect that we get sober together and we bury our dead together. You know, I'm proud to be a member of this fellowship. I'm proud to do this stuff. You know, where do you get that? I continue to go on, and life went on, and we're doing fine now. You know, I ended up getting gifts in Alcoholics. I just quit blowing my money. You know, material things is just a natural byproduct to quit blowing your money, right? You know, I ended up getting a few houses. You know, I got three dogs. I got three houses. I got one cat. I got two jobs. I got one wife. I've been blessed with a wonderful wife, blessed. And I never thought I'd have any of this. I never wanted any of this. You know, I was just a loner, a selfish, self-centered. I didn't care about anything or anybody. My life is full today. You know, what do I got to say? Where do I say thanks for all that? You know, we got this wonderful AA household, and really, I sit there, I listen to her talking to a new girl, and I don't know if the new girl's hearing anything, but I'm sitting there with a pad and pencil. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. You know, I got to tell my guys this. We don't talk about feelings, you know. It makes sense. Every day brings, you know, and it's really truth. It's not all lollipops and rainbows, you know. But it's sober living, you know. It's real life. It's vital, and it's the way I always wanted to feel. It's what I was looking for in those bars, looking at all them colored bottles, look all that. And it wasn't to be found there at all. It was to be found here, in this blue book we got here, and in this fellowship where we get together and we share this stuff and, from the heart. And that's where it comes from, and most notably from faith and reliance in a higher power. You know, that's what you told me for develops, and also known as God. You know, develop a faith and reliance in a higher power. And I was raised Christian and all that type of thing, and I didn't know anything about that until I started developing it in these rooms. And trying to just follow your stuff, you know, your examples. You know, I want the ease and comfort that the people in the back row at my home group exhibit, and that's where they get it. That's what they tell me, and I got to believe them because everything else they've told me was true. You know, and even if I don't believe it, I'm going to try it. I'm going to fold my tickets the same way. I'm going to laugh when you laugh. I'm going to get up and pick up your new guys, and I'm going to go to my meetings and say my prayers and do everything I can because I want what you guys got. You know, I want to be able to be the strength that's exhibited to me from people doing the right thing, even when their peers look down on them. But real men and real women living a vital life and doing the right thing in life is all I ever wanted to do. I wanted to be the man I always wanted to be, and I found that example in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, thank you guys for that. You know, there's a story about the search for diamonds in Africa, right? They were looking for these diamonds, and they went out into the fields, and they dug into the yellow clay, and they found diamonds, and they picked up these diamonds, and they took it back to the village, and it was great. You know, they were ecstatic at the wealth of their find. But eventually the wealth runs out, and they had to go get more. And this time they went out into the field, and they dug deeper. They went through the yellow clay into the blue clay. And if you know anything about diamonds in Africa, it's in the blue clay where the true mother lode is found. And that's what they found. What they found made what they previously found pale in insignificance. And that's kind of like spirituality in this program with me. You know, just taking away the drink, my life improved 1,000%, and truth be told, it probably would have been good enough. But I want the blue clay. You know, I want to dig a little bit deeper. And that's what I'm after today. I'm trying to dig a little bit deeper, and I'm trying to dig farther. And I want to get that that spirituality that I see exhibited in those guys at my home group, in doing the next right thing and being courageous. And I'm not talking about up here at podiums, and it's the quiet things they do in the back row and talking to the new guys and the kind acts and the good deeds and going through the ups and downs of life gracefully and having the courage to do that. They're real men, and that's what I want to be. You know, there was a, speaking of my home group, there was an anonymous guy by the name of Dick Poutney who... you know, I wanted it all right away, and as the story goes, you know, Dick was a very influential person. He helped hundreds of alcoholics. He was he started a school. He was and a very accomplished person and highly respected. And a new guy came up to him at a meeting one time, envying his years of sobriety and all his life's good things he did in life, and said, "Wow, Dick, 30 years." And Dick slammed down his hand like a gavel and says, "I'll trade you even my 30 years for your 30 days right now." You know, because Dick knew what the new guy had yet to learn was that true happiness is found in the journey, not the destination. It's found one day at a time, living this life sober, the good and the bad. We wouldn't know the good but for the bad. I'll trade you even right now. I didn't understand that at first, but I do now. I'll trade you even my 30 years for your 30 days right now, because I'd love to go through this ride again. It's been a wild ride. New guys, buckle up. You know, if you climb on this train, buckle up, because they told me it keeps getting better. I didn't believe it, but they're right. You know, I used to think it was just that I keep putting a buck in a basket. Mm-mm, you know. And really, on a very real sense, that's really one of the most important things we do is what we did here tonight, or on a small scale. We come to the meeting, we take up a chair, put a buck in a basket. And that's where it happened for me some 18 years ago, when those people did their job that night. They came to the meeting, took up a chair, put a buck in a basket. Thank God for that, to a guy who's going out and celebrating the next day, and I've never had to. You know, am I grateful enough for that? So I'd like to thank you guys for coming in this celebration of sobriety, doing what we do, enjoying life, and being the examples that we are. And I heard it walking down the hallway here, man. It's just, you know, the conferences and the Cook Forests and the Founders Days and the World Conferences and all the celebrations, you know, there's just so much. It's such a rich, I used to wonder, what the heck am I going to do sober? Man, I'll tell you. You don't have to worry about it. Nature abhors a vacuum, and man, it just, but I love it. I love it, and I'd like to thank you guys for coming. Once again, I'd like to thank the committee for all the activity that they do here and putting this thing together, all their hard work, and I'd like to thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and that old-timer that told me humility is the key. Cool.